From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. In order to look at energy in the United States, we need to examine how we use energy, how we generate that energy, and the waste products and pollution both create. Joseph Rahm is Special Assistant for Policy and Planning to the Deputy Secretary of Energy. As the Executive Director of DOE's Pollution Prevention and Waste Minimization Executive Board, he looks at the total energy picture of American corporations and large organizations. We'll talk about how recent advances in environmental technology are positively affecting the very economics of doing business. I'll also speak with David Rawson. A former Assistant Secretary of Energy, Dr. Rawson is participating in the current efforts of DOE to formulate a new national energy policy plan. We'll discuss the climate in the United States for nuclear energy and where it might fit today in a national plan. In his capacity with the Department of Energy, Joe Rahm has the opportunity to work with hundreds of American businesses. In his new book, Lean and Clean Management, he suggests that companies can actually reduce pollution and, as a direct result, also boost profits and competitiveness. I commented that his premise was opposite to accepted thinking.
There's no question that in the last few years, a lot of businesses have demonstrated that you can increase profits and be good for the environment at the same time. The main point is that you have to prevent the pollution in the first place. We've historically, people have seen pollution coming out of businesses as something you treat or you dispose of or you burn. So then pollution is just an added cost, an added burden. The best businesses today try to prevent the pollution in the first place by designing new processes or using more efficient use of their resources so that they purchase less energy, water, materials, and they produce less pollution. So you kind of save money at both ends and become a more efficient business.
Well, I guess that's true. If you're producing things and you have excess at the end, let's say you're making orange slices, so you grow oranges and you have all these orange peels. You say, oh, I got all these extra orange peels, so we'll just burn them or bury them or cart them off someplace. But in fact, if your total design process says, well, before we start on these oranges, let's make sure we have a product with orange peels. Is that sort of what you were talking about here?
Well, yes, and it can even go further than that, where you can actually, for instance, if you have a chemical that's now a hazardous waste like a chlorofluorocarbon, which destroys the environment, you could say, can I look at my entire production process and figure out a way not to dispose of it when I'm done or even sell it, but to redesign the process so I don't use the chlorofluorocarbon at all?
I would say that one fact that people have sort of skimmed over is that we're also amazed at the massive explosion in personal computers and the like, all the attendant elements. And there's a lot of pollution created by producing personal computers. In your book, you use a lot of examples of companies. Let's take your examples from the Compaq Computer Company. Let's talk about computer companies.
Well, I think what we're seeing now with computer companies is something that Compaq did early on, and that's why I say in the book that they're sort of one of the first lean and clean companies, because they, long before it was fashionable, really made a huge effort to run very energy-efficient operation. And in fact, the facilities manager at Compaq, a guy named Ron Perkins, realized that his goal was not just to save energy, but really to create the kind of work environment that optimizes the productivity of workers. So he actually asked Compaq employees what kind of workspaces do they like. Well, the number one thing that their employees liked is daylighting, which comes as no shock. I think everyone likes daylighting. And so they consciously designed buildings that would make more use of daylight. And the nice thing about daylight, of course, is the energy is free and it's renewable. And they would create very nice climates to work in, a lot of access to daylight, very energy-efficient lighting, computer controls of their systems so that people would, you know, be able to optimize the systems, and heating and cooling systems that people would have more control of, a lot more thermostats in the offices so that individuals could adjust them more. And overall, Compaq was able to save a considerable amount of money in energy, but I think more importantly, create a kind of space that in fact increase the productivity of the workers. And then one of the things I discuss in the book is how you design an office space or a manufacturing plant that is both energy efficient and increases productivity.
I guess that's one area that is a little fuzzy for me. How do you measure increases in productivity? And part of that is increase in job satisfaction and happiness. How do you measure that?
Well, it varies by industry. In some of the companies that I look at in the book, it's quality of work. If you're a manufacturing company, it's very easy to measure productivity. How many units per hour do you put out? And what's the defect rate? And if the lighting is better, then your quality is going to go up. And I have several examples of Boeing and Hyde Tools, companies that do detailed manufacturing work. They put in lighting upgrades simply to save energy, and also because the Environmental Protection Agency has this green lights program, which rewards companies that agree to run more energy efficient lighting. And most of the lighting improvements, you know, paid for themselves in 2 years. So they were very cost effective for the business. But the sort of this unexpected side effect was that the new lighting that we have has much reduced glare, there's less flicker, there's better color rendition, and the amount of defects went down. So that's sort of one way you can measure productivity. Other ways include, I have a couple examples. There's the post office. How many letters are they able to sort per hour? There's an insurance company. How many claims are they able to process per day? Different companies have different measures. One of the easiest things that every business tracks is absenteeism. And if you create the kind of workspace that people like to work in, absenteeism goes down. And if the air quality, indoor air quality improves, then diseases, you know, there's less spreading of diseases and germs. So people feel better about work. There's less disease. So absenteeism goes down. So there's several examples, including some from, the Northern California area of businesses that actually reduced absenteeism with environmental design of their buildings.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Joseph Rome. He's the Special Assistant for Policy and Planning to the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Energy. We're talking about his new book, Lean and Clean Management. What does lean and clean mean?
Well, we've seen a big wave of total quality management and lean production in American industry. Lean means high productivity workplaces, empowered employees, emphasis on quality, cutting costs and keeping quality high. Clean is how do you reduce pollution? How do you reduce energy consumption and water consumption, air pollution, solid waste, hazardous chemicals? And so the two of them together are sort of how do you become the most efficient, high productivity operation that you possibly can. In fact, one of the things I talk about is lean operations minimize wasted time. They try to have a very fast product cycle time with a minimum amount of errors and defects and rework. Clean companies try to minimize wasted resources. So the sort of the two of them together are trying to minimize waste throughout the system. In lean management or total quality, you try to prevent defects, design quality in. In clean companies, you try to prevent pollution and you design environmental consciousness in. So both of them, you have to focus on design. You need a lot of teamwork because different people know different things about what pollutes the environment and they need to be brought in early into the process. So that's sort of lean and clean, the two of them together.
Certainly the examples you were giving in terms of moving the workplace forward brought to mind for me when I read it that the technology of what is available and what it does for us has changed dramatically. So that if you have a firm that's in a building that's, you know, 30 years old or 20 years old, which is not that old, it was built probably with technology that was that old. And what has come about is that new technology in all of these areas are now making the chance for a better result possible.
Oh, absolutely. I would say that anybody who's listening who is not done a lighting upgrade in their building since, let's say, 1990, would benefit both from cost savings, from environmental responsibility, but also make their employees happier. I think the technologies that you now see in the last 2 or 3 years are fundamentally different, even than they were 5 years ago. And we can now, If you look up and you see fluorescent lighting fixtures that have four bulbs in them, that means you've got an old, out-of-date system. We now have new systems that allow you to reduce the number of bulbs and increase the amount of light. They eliminate that annoying ultraviolet flicker with the invention of something called the electronic ballast, which is also more energy efficient. And there are now more sophisticated controls, which actually allow you to tie the fluorescent lights to photocells that monitor how bright it is from the daylight. And if it's very bright outside, it dims the fluorescent lights. And if it's dark or cloudy outside, it raises them up. So people... Plus, we have occupancy sensors that are much better than they used to be. Sometimes people would sit in their rooms and the lights would go out. Now we have now they have ones that are thermally activated.
So as long as you're alive.
As long as you're alive, yes, yes. So we have better controls, we have better technology, we have better designers, and the local utility should be able to help you with this. And also, I would recommend people sign up for EPA's Green Lights Program, which is a voluntary program that provides information on how you, what technologies are best for what workspace and how to get financing.
So the Environmental Protection Agency, therefore, supports companies to move forward into this green lighting.
They've been very supportive of this because it's one of the single biggest ways to prevent air pollution. I mean, the air pollution generated from power plants that are powering inefficient light bulbs are just generating a lot of pollution. Lighting in this country costs Americans, just the energy, $40 billion a year. So it is a huge expenditure for that energy, and that energy typically is generating pollution. And most people, some of the companies like Boeing in the book, in some places they are actually able to cut lighting electricity 90%. I'd say almost any office building that hasn't had an upgrade in the last 4 or 5 years could probably cut lighting easily 60% and pay for it in 2 years. And I'm just looking in the studio here, and I see a lot of incandescent bulbs, and yet we don't really have a need for them. We could probably cut the lighting bill here with no reduction in quality by 60, 70%.
Now, I have to say, I'm an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco, and part of the university is an old and genteel college, the old San Francisco College for Women. It has had these beautiful wrought iron chandeliers in every room and throughout, and in an energy efficient fit, public safety went through and engineering and replaced them all with fluorescent lights, and I'm holding you responsible. Sure, they've got function, but they don't have form. I mean, this beautiful building and these beautiful fixtures, and now all these fluorescent lights are there. Certainly the lighting is better, certainly it's more energy efficient, but we have to have some form to this function. I mean, what can we do without, if we're in these beautiful old buildings and we don't want to have that look?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think the new lighting is necessarily appropriate everywhere, and certainly in people's homes they may not choose to have, you know, all of the latest technology. And I think in certain, you know, historic settings, I think the most important thing is to talk to the people in the workspace. This is one of the most essential points. Ask the people, find out what kind of light they want. If it's there decorative, then it's very important that you keep decorative light. But if people need light to do work, to read, I mean, most offices, after all, are designed, even today, the lighting was designed for when people wrote on desks and not computers. And that's why most offices today have glare on their computers, which makes it harder to read. Half of all office workers complain about eye strain. That can all be avoided with new lighting.
One thing that's interesting, it's not just do you have incandescent or the old ones and fluorescent and what else is coming on. You alluded to it earlier. The mixture of natural light itself has a real clear economic value, but just in terms of you're not replacing that light. But you had an interesting example in the Walmart story. Tell us about that.
Well, Walmart is a company that is really, it does a lot of construction. I think it does like a store every 2 days. So they've decided that they want to become more environmentally responsible. And some people may have seen the TV ads for their Lawrence, Kansas store, which they call the Echo Mart, which has a recycling center. And it's a very energy efficient store. It has a lot of environmental features. One of the features is skylights, which obviously is a way of bringing daylight into the space. in order to save money, Walmart only put the skylights in half the store, and they noticed a very unexpected effect. All of Walmart's cash registers are tied back to the Arkansas headquarters, so Walmart can track sales and rapidly respond to customer demands, sort of an essential part of total quality management. They were able to notice, because of this tracking, that in the daylit half of the store, the sales per square foot was more than 10% higher. And this caught their attention because they're in the business of selling. And I think people like daylighting more. And so they've decided they're going to, you know, their future stores are going to use more daylighting and be more energy efficient. And they may even do some retrofitting of old stores, because skylights are something that are relatively easy to put in, certainly in new construction, but even in upgrades of old facilities.
The thing that's interesting about that is that once you put them in, they basically don't cost you anything.
No, they're I mean, obviously, sunlight is the most cheapest form of daylighting, and it's very easy to do. And I think it creates a lot of diversity. And there's nothing like natural light. I think anyone who's been in an office building where there's an atrium, it's a fundamentally different kind of space than an office that doesn't have one.
I think also that points up to engineering. Quite often we'll be going down a road saying, how do we get this, our electric bill cheaper, as an example, and how do we get these to be cheaper this and cheaper that, and how do we, well, maximize how long the bulbs will last, et cetera. And then something will come in from the side, such as somebody puts a skylight in, completely unexpected, for who knows what reason, and it changes the whole ball game. It's like, oh, what we can do with half the fixtures half of the day, because it's going to be light outside. It's like, you don't worry, it changes the economics of how you look at it. My guest today is Joseph Rome, Executive Director of the Department of Energy's Pollution Prevention and Waste Minimization Executive Board. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You're involved in developing energy policy for the Department of Energy. Is it in your charter to balance energy policy with the needs of the American economy as a whole, or just simply to look at energy?
No, it's our goal is to really try to balance and integrate energy policy, environmental concerns, and economic concerns. I think, you know, we've had this debate about jobs versus the environment for many, many years, but I think at the department, you know, Hazel O'Leary, the secretary, and my boss, Bill White, are absolutely convinced that you can reconcile the two. The trick is, you know, how do you increase productivity, develop new technologies that are both good for the environment and good for business? The department, for instance, is responsible for developing many of these new lighting technologies. Just this electronic ballast I mentioned that eliminates the flicker and the hum of fluorescent bulbs was developed for $3 million in the late 1970s, and it has already saved American businesses and consumers a total of $850 million in energy costs. So here's a technology. It reduces air pollution. It improves the quality of lighting. And at the same time, it lowers businesses' costs. It was a very rapid payback. So we're in the midst of trying to develop technologies that will help businesses reduce their pollution, and not just energy use, but whole systems approach. Can we, for instance, work with the refining industry, or can we work with the pulp and paper industry to develop an industry of the future that is very energy efficient, very low polluting, and at the same time highly productive and competitive? And we really see minimizing waste as a real competitive opportunity for the country, not to mention if the United States can be the leader in clean technology development, there'll be a very large export market overseas, as other countries also want, you know, clean technologies.
Let's turn to another front. Some of your earlier work, certainly at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, related energy and national security. When does energy policy become sort of national security policy?
Well, I think obviously there's always been a lot of concern over the supply of oil. And as a result, you know, even now, you know, we're always seem to be concerned about what's going on in the Middle East. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that 60% of the world's oil reserves are in the Middle East. So whatever the Department of Energy can do to get people off of wasting oil is obviously good for the national security as well as good for the economy. And it should be said, the trade deficit, because the trade deficit is roughly $40 billion of the trade deficit is oil. So the department is working very actively to develop technologies, super efficient automobiles, new forms of batteries, fuel cells that will allow us to have transportation and other industrial uses that formerly were used by oil, but now either will be more efficient or used by other fuels.
So it seems to me that if the Department of Energy can keep the energy sources within the United States, then you reduce this need for national security. The more that comes from, has to be imported, the more it affects the national security. And that's sort of the relation there.
Well, it's one of the relations. I think the other way to say it is also that's traditional national security, but there are a lot of people who think national security also includes economic security and environmental security, concerns about the global environment, and also the standard of living in this country. So to the extent that energy drives the economy, if we can use it more efficiently, if we can create jobs, and if we can increase competitiveness of U.S. industries and reduce pollution all at the same time, then we're kind of wrapping economic security, energy security, environmental security all together with national security. And I think it's that synthesis, again, it's lean and clean, combining the economic, the energy, and the environmental all together.
Certainly it's been in the last 20 years that we've really become conscious of the environmental concerns, and yet the philosophy of lean and clean has been around with many of America's most successful companies. You even quoted Henry Ford in that. So tell us about what it was before we got so, you know, sort of set up and, okay, we're going to include the environmental concerns as well.
Well, I think, you know, Henry Ford, as I talk about in one of the chapters, it is not really widely known, but he actually practiced clean manufacturing, and he was obsessed with eliminating waste. He used timber very efficiently. He recycled it. He would use the waste wood and get energy from it, and he would get oil from it. He would be very efficient with the use of steel. But fundamentally, American industry didn't really have to focus on energy and resource concerns because this country was rich in natural resources. Even as late as the 1950s, we produced twice as much oil as the Middle East and North Africa combined. So we were really created on a pool of natural resources. And at the same time, we had a lot of open space, which allowed us to kind of spread pollution, waste around, and we didn't have to think about it. Now that environmental concerns are rising to the forefront and our resource base is not as strong as it used to be, a lot of people are saying, you know, how can we use it more efficiently? And I think the best companies have been efficient, you know, for 10 years or 15 years, but they're really, this is really, I think, a new switch from thinking about pollution. Don't deal with it at the end of this pipe, but actually use resources more efficiently and prevent pollution in the first place. And I think this is a relatively new trend for most companies.
You had so many examples of companies. How did you go around collecting all this data?
Well, I was trying to find examples of fairly mainstream companies, you know, Compaq Computer, Walmart, Boeing, not exotic companies that you necessarily think of as environmental, but companies that were just trying to go about their business and found that environmental concerns, you know, becoming efficient was actually good for the bottom line. And I spoke to a lot of executives. The key, I think, for me was to try to find examples not just of improving environmental performance and cutting costs, but cases where productivity rose. Because I've found that, you know, frankly, businesses are much more concerned about productivity and quality of work than they are about some other things. So I was really trying to find real win-win cases for energy, the economy, and the environment. And it surprised me how many there are, but they're quite recent, and I think this book could not have been written even 2 years ago. This has really been a fundamental shift in what some of our best companies have been doing.
What's going to be the effect? Do you think that our energy consumption is going to go down or not?
Well, I think what you'll see is energy consumption will probably grow, but fairly slowly over time. I think what you're going to see in everyone's lifetime is probably, you know, in 2020, 2025, in that time frame, industrial pollution will eventually become a thing of the past. I think really most companies are trying to get out of the pollution business. And they used to think of it as a burden, but now they really see pollution as a measure of their own inefficiency. And just like companies used to track defects and try to reduce them, they now track pollution and they try to reduce that. So I think you're going to see, it's going to take a little while because it's a fairly big shift in thinking for a lot of companies. But I think pollution, industrial pollution in 25 years will start to be a thing of the past in this country. And I think we will have a lot fewer power plants as a result. And in some states, like California, you're not going to see very many new large power plants at all because they're going to get most of their new energy supply from energy efficiency. And I think the states that lead the way on this are going to find a lot of benefits for their companies.
Joe, thank you for joining me. My guest today has been Joseph Rome of the U.S. Department of Energy. His new book is Lean and Clean Management, How to Boost Profits and Productivity by Reducing Pollution, published by Kodansha International. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Dr. Rawson is a former Assistant Secretary of Energy, and he is currently participating in formulating a new national energy policy plan. I asked him about the elements of that plan and how the Department of Energy is going about creating it.
Any agency would like to be able to lay out a plan that says this is what we want to do so that they can go to Congress and justify their budget. And the Department of Energy has to do this every few years. We did it when I was there. And they're doing it now. The difference is that the plan this year focuses on cleaning up the laboratories and the factories that were used years ago for the programs of the Atomic Energy Commission, some of them as far back as the 1940s. It focuses on environmental restoration of the property. It focuses on basic research, which is good, and it's very important because the Department of Energy funds some of the best basic research in the country. And it focuses on sustainable development and sustainable energy for the future. I have no argument with these goals. I think they're good. I do have an argument with two of them in the way they're being implemented. I believe that there is much too much being done in terms of paper studies about how this cleanup should be done. It's not complicated. It's a lot of rather direct work has to be done carefully, but it's not as all-fired complex as they're making it out to be. And I think a lot of money, is taxpayers' money, is being wasted while they go over one paper study after another. I think they should go ahead and get the job done on the cleanup, and I don't think it's going to cost all the billions of dollars that people are talking about. A lot of that is going to be spent just keeping people around while they do more paper studies. There's no point to that. The other part where I disagree is really the fundamental one, and that's energy for the future. We've got to think in terms of a sustainable energy future, and that's an obligation of our generation to the future. And although the Department of Energy talks about sustainable development, their plan doesn't include anything that really helps us achieve that kind of goal. And I don't see anything in the initial plans that they've talked about up to now that says we're going to do anything about energy for the long term. They talk about conservation, and that's fine. That's going to slow down the growth of energy increase, and that's good. But it's not going to stop that growth, and it's certainly not going to do anything to replace old generating facilities that have to be shut down because they're no longer economic or cost too much to maintain, and replace them with new ones. It really doesn't offer anything new in that area at all. In fact, I think the big worry about and a difficulty in developing an energy policy is that the only thing we really have to put into it as far as electricity is concerned is burn more natural gas to make electricity. And that doesn't constitute a sustainable energy future.
Now let's go down these two paths separately. You know, one is the cleanup of what's here, and the other is where we're going to go from here and how can we do it in a way that will keep us on an even keel.
Well, let's start with that second one first, okay?
Okay.
Let's talk about the future because I think that's really the most critical of these issues. The other one is very important. We have to do it. But this one requires, I think, some fresh thinking and maybe even a return to some very clear thinking that was on the table at one time but has been politically removed. And you know what I'm getting at. I'm getting at nuclear energy. It works. One-fifth of the nation's electricity comes from nuclear.
Today.
In Illinois, where I used to work for the utility, it's 75%. 75% in Illinois, a coal state. And the reason is because it works and it works well. It works reliably. It's economical. The big problems with the cost of nuclear were the cost of plants that were delayed during construction. But in terms of operating costs, nuclear competes well with coal. I'll tell you what it doesn't compete well with right now. Gas is cheap. And as long as gas is cheap, it's a lot cheaper to build a plant that'll burn gas. The only question is, how much of this do you want to do? And I contend you want to do some, but you don't want to stake your future on it because natural gas is a limited resource. It's a very valuable fuel. It's excellent for home heating and cooking. It's excellent for certain industrial processes. It's a feedstock for fertilizer. And without an adequate supply of natural gas, we would have a very different chemical industry and a very different society. I've been in some countries that don't have natural gas, and they have to import fertilizer, and they have to import plastics and chemicals that they can't make themselves because they don't have the feedstock, the natural gas. Now, here we are burning more and more to generate electricity when we have other options. We can burn coal more cleanly now, so we ought to be using that in certain areas. We've got the technology to produce economical nuclear power, and we know that it works. And I think we ought to be moving in the next few years to starting to order nuclear power plants again for the future. There hasn't been a new nuclear plant ordered that was finished, was actually completed, since 1973. That's the last time a plant was ordered that was finished. All of them ordered after 73 were ultimately canceled. So we've really had a 20-year moratorium. And I think it's going to be time, it is time, but it's going to be appropriate in a few years to put nuclear back into the marketplace.
Why is nuclear sustainable versus natural gas or coal? Why is that considered? Is it more sustainable? I mean, what are we talking about here?
The way we run our nuclear plants now, we use uranium, which is a natural element in the earth, and the amount of uranium in the earth is limited. It's limited just like natural gas or coal is limited. There is quite a bit of it. We really get into the question of the long-term future, and several countries, Japan, France, and others are, of course, looking at it, recognize what we used to do, or the way we used to look at it in previous decades, and that was, with the appropriate technology, we can recycle nuclear fuel and get a lot more out of it. The Carter administration pulled the plug on that research, not completely, but almost. And Jimmy Carter said nuclear power was the energy source of last resort. And that really threw the nuclear's future into a whole different path than it had been before that. Now we're looking at, if we look at 100 or 200 years into the future, we know that we can't make it an advanced civilization on just oil and gas. We just can't do it. And so sooner or later, we're going to have to use these advanced technologies to recycle and make more fuel and get more fuel energy out of the original uranium. It's not politically popular now. And it's a very uphill fight in Washington. In fact, they just killed the research on this just a couple of months ago. So I'm not sure when the United States will reconsider this. I hope they will reconsider it in a few years and go ahead. But the plants that we have now, we have enough uranium for them, plenty of uranium. There are uranium finds in Australia and Africa and other places that are going to allow us to go ahead with nuclear for the time being. That's not going to do it for the long-term future. We're going to have to go to recycle and that kind of technology in the long term. What we're looking at is the new designs that are ready to be ordered or will be ready to be ordered in a couple of years when the safety reviews are completed. And then utilities will be able to make a decision about whether to order a new nuclear plant or not. Today, nuclear power is not in the marketplace in the U.S.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. David Rawson. He's a former Assistant Secretary of Energy and past president of the American Nuclear Society. Well, you've just been alluding to the fact that there has been technological development in nuclear power plants since 1973, whatever was the last time we built one and put it underway. Has that development primarily been going out on outside the United States?
We haven't been totally out of it. More development has gone on outside the United States in terms of designing and building new plants. But I said that we haven't ordered any new plants in the last 20 years that have been completed. There were a number of them ordered up until 1978. They were canceled. And we haven't ordered any new ones since then. What we have been doing, though, is completing the ones that were ordered before that time and putting them into operation, and we're now operating 108 plants, making one-fifth of our electricity. And we've learned an awful lot in that period of time. We've learned how to solve a lot of problems, and we've discovered a lot of problems, discovered a lot of solutions to go with them. We know how to operate them more reliably. Our national average reliability record is substantially better than it was back in the 70s, and certainly a lot better than it was in the early 80s. We've learned how to make our operators more effective, more reliable, more comfortable. We redesigned all the control rooms in the United States to make them more user-friendly. Mm-hmm. We called it human factors engineering. Part of that came from bad experience. It came from the Three Mile Island accident, where nobody was hurt in the Three Mile Island accident, but the plant was totally damaged. And as a result, we learned a lot of things that we could improve on, and particularly the whole idea of making the control rooms and the instruments more user-friendly is one of the most important lessons that was learned from Three Mile Island.
Well, what about Chernobyl? Has the U.S. learned anything from Chernobyl?
Chernobyl is a very special case because we don't have any plants that are designed like the Chernobyl plants. In fact, the only ones are in Russia, the Ukraine, and Lithuania. It's a design that the Russians tried to market around the world 25 years ago, and nobody would buy it. We looked at it, and we had no interest in it. It's not a good design. It'll run, and it can be run safely if people are careful and if they do some upgrades that we and other nations are helping them to do. Even though it's not as safe a design as ours, the risks involved in shutting the plants down are substantially greater than the risks of running them. Not because there's a risk from the radiation or shutdown of the nuclear plant or the waste, but the fact that they don't have enough electricity. And without those plants, large regions of Russia and the Ukraine would be without electricity, and the regions close to the plant without heat, because those plants actually supply the heat for the apartments and the homes and the factories in the surrounding villages. So it's not a matter of saying, well, we can eliminate all the risk by shutting down the plants. We can't do that. And the Russians can't do that, and they won't. And they've made it very clear in international meetings that while they're very eager to get our help in improving their instruments and improving their operator training and in making some changes in the hardware that will improve the safety of the plants, that they can't even seriously consider shutting them down until they have not only power to replace them, but enough power to meet their needs. They don't have enough electricity to meet their needs today.
I think there's a common perception that nuclear energy is very dangerous in the sort of the general public. I mean, it's like, oh my goodness, you could have Three Mile Island, you could have Chernobyl. And at the same time, you say, well, we've done a lot of improvements in technology. We've really learned a lot. And it's like, well, we can understand that, but how do I feel better about it? Then I think many people are surprised to hear, they said, gee, we're not building any new plants, to realize there's over 100 plants in operation in the United States today, that they are and continue to operate safely, that they provide one-fifth of the energy. And from a political standpoint, the politicians certainly can't put forward, let's build a lot of nuclear plants right away. That's sort of unpopular. And at the same time, it would be tremendously dramatic to shut down immediately one-fifth of our power.
It would be very dramatic.
And nobody's going to do that. So
I don't think so. A lot of things which we're accustomed to doing would not be possible to do anymore. I was in a debate once years ago with a fellow who was a very emotional environmentalist. And it was before a League of Women Voters group in Chicago. At that very moment, half the electricity in the entire Northern Illinois region was nuclear. And he said, we don't need these plants. We can shut them down at any time. And I said, well, that's fine. It's easy to say, but half the electricity that we're getting right now in this room is from nuclear power. Well, he went over to the wall switch, and there were two switches, and he turned off one of them. Half the lights in the room went out, and all the audience cheered and applauded. Well, they thought that was great. And I said, well, would you like to try going down to the south side of Chicago to the steel mills and shutting off half their power? No, that's, you can't say that. That's not fair. Well, it is fair. The problem is this is a real world. And electricity is a very remarkable commodity. Electricity is generated at the very instant you use it. There's one exception. That's batteries, like transistor radios, flashlights. Otherwise, electricity is generated the instant you use it. You don't generate more electricity than there are things out there for it to work on. You can argue about whether people are careful about the way they use electricity. I mean, do we have too many lights on? Do we set the air conditioning at a temperature that's too cold? Maybe we could set it a little higher. Energy saving is not the most critical thing in our lives. There are a lot of things that are very important, and one of the things that's more important than saving a little electricity is probably making sure that it's reliable and it's there when you really do need it. We've gotten into this dilemma a lot. On the other hand, people can be more careful about the way they use energy. Very few people wake up in the morning and say, the most important thing I'm going to do today is use less energy. It's low on your priority list. What's much higher on people's lists is, I'd better have electricity, because we have come to the point in this country where people regard electricity not as a service that you buy, but as a right.
My guest today is Dr. David Rawson. He was formerly the director of the Nuclear Safety Analysis Center at EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, and his early research at Argonne National Laboratories was in the area of reactor safety and radiation effects on materials. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Where is energy research going at the national laboratories, and how has defense spending and the cuts therein affected it?
They're really two separate issues, Moira. The defense-related work, the old weapons program, has been cut back over the last decade tremendously. And the end of the Cold War really meant the end of a whole era of weapons production. There is still research on weapons, and there will have to be, but it's going to be really a small part of what was going on a long time ago. And it doesn't have very much impact on the energy questions. The defense laboratories and the research and commercial laboratories, even though there was research work going on at the weapons laboratories, it was really separate to a great extent from the civilian energy programs. I see a rather limited attention on the part of the Department of Energy on energy in the future. There's a lot being talked about and written about sustainable development, but there isn't much research on energy for the future. It doesn't take research to figure out how to burn more natural gas. It's a standard technology. And, you know, the commercial people who make gas turbines can improve by a fraction of a percentage point in efficiency, but you don't have to fund a national research program to figure out how to burn natural gas. We've tried to figure out ways to burn less oil. We've tried to figure out ways to change the energy mix in certain ways that will improve our environment. And California has legislated technology. They've said that starting 1997, we're going to have to start moving toward non-polluting cars, and we're going to have 1 or 2%. I've forgotten just when the figure kicks in. The cars in California have to be zero-emission cars. Well, that's electric. I think there's no question that in the large cities of the United States, one of the things we're going to see over the next 20, 30 years is an increase in the number of electric vehicles. And personally, I don't think it's going to be quite so much in the area of cars. I think it's going to be delivery vehicles and shuttle buses. I see no reason for a shuttle bus to be standing there with its motor running and exhaust fumes coming out while you're waiting for people to get on and off. An electric vehicle can be charged at the end of its route, or charged at night and then run during the day. But that's the kind of thinking that we're going to have to do a lot more of, and we're going to have to look and see how we can do it. Because if you look at congested cities in the U.S. and other places around the world, the big problem is emissions from automobiles and trucks. Buses. We've really got to get somewhere on that. And as a result, we're going to have to do some serious thinking about energy supply.
So research is more in the area of improving the use of electricity once delivered.
Yes,
in those areas.
I think so. The one exception is very long range, and that's fusion. And we've dreamed about fusion for a long time. Ironically, we're still not at the point with fusion that Enrico Fermi and his team was 50 years ago under the grandstands at the University of Chicago when they first made a nuclear chain reaction that was sustainable. We haven't reached that point with fusion yet, even though we've spent $30 or $40 billion on it in research. So the problems are very severe, very complex, and I think we'll continue to do research on it. It may or may not ever come through as a commercial power source. It may turn out to have value in a totally different way. I just don't know. And that's one thing about research. You're never 100% sure how it's going to come out. So I don't see any breakthroughs, immediate breakthroughs. And when it comes to energy, something as important as energy, you can't start planning your future on something until it really is proven. Nuclear power was not a factor in America's energy planning until the 1960s, when a number of commercial nuclear plants were actually being built and put into operation and proved they could operate. Up until then, it was all dreams and paper studies and designs and pilot plants and experiments. And until you had the first few in operation, you couldn't really plan on it contributing a significant amount of energy. Now, let me just go to the other question that we talked about at the beginning and held off for a few minutes, and that's the question about what you do with the waste. Because with any way of making energy, you're going to have some waste products. Even with natural gas, you get nitrogen oxides that are of concern. It's interesting. You don't really have waste products to worry about with solar or hydroelectric dams or wind power. That's fine. But those sources, as interesting and as important as they are, have limitations in terms of the quantities that they can supply. We're not going to build any more new big dams in the United States. And solar and wind are great, but they're only going to supply a small fraction. And it's nice to have that, but it doesn't compete with nuclear. They're totally different. If you get some solar or wind power, you can cut back on the natural gas you burn, and that's a saving. but it's not going to replace the need for more plants in the future. But when you talk about burning fuel, whether it's oil, gas, or coal, you have emissions that you have to be concerned about. When you burn nuclear fuel, you have radioactive waste, and those have to be disposed of. I've always been concerned that some of the people that I end up arguing with in the environmental community are opposed to disposing of the waste. I mean, morally, it's our responsibility. We know how to do it. And yet they go into court and fight any efforts to try and get a waste repository built. They take their case to Congress, and Congress is very confused on this issue. We really have two totally different kinds of waste to worry about. One is the highly radioactive material that's in the nuclear fuel, and that's going to be buried deep in the earth, 1,000 feet below the surface. And the studies are being done on a mountain in the desert in Nevada called Yucca Mountain. People are worried about that. Well, I don't blame them for being worried, but I think the answers are there if they want to see them. And interestingly, they're going to bury that radioactive material in engineered containers, in carefully built mine shafts. They're really not that huge. I mean, we're talking about a facility that's about the size of an average coal mine. But they're going to be buried deep in the ground and then carefully backfilled with 1,000 feet of rock. And 40 miles away, there are a number of holes in the ground that were made by exploding atomic bombs underground, because that was the testing range. So people who are 100 miles away from the proposed waste repository say they're worried, but they live 60 miles away from where there were exploding bombs under the ground, and they didn't seem to be particularly worried about that. So it's a.
But they didn't know about that, did
they? Oh, they knew. Oh, sure they knew. Like,
now,
sure,
are you telling me that under the ground there's still radioactive material?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Those bomb craters, yeah. Those bomb craters are filled with fused silica, glass, and radioactive fission products from those bomb explosions, sure.
Well, I have to say that when Glenn Seaborg looked me in the eye, he said, well, you know, this radioactive material doesn't move around under the ground.
No, it really doesn't. You're talking about something.
It took Glenn Seaborg looking me in the eye.
Well, I wish I could be as...
better of plutonium. Okay, Dr. Seaborg,
I wish I could be as convincing as Glenn Seaborg. He's one of my idols. But what he said is true. You're talking about stuff that's going to take very huge cranes and lifts and machinery to get it in place, and it's not going to walk away by itself. It's not going to slither around through the ground down there and come up someplace else. Politically, I think that issue is beginning to recede. The state of Nevada fought it tooth and nail for a number of years, but Congress finally said, basically, look, Nevada, you don't have anything to gripe about. We're giving you extra money for this. Now, please, stop interfering with it. Let the work go on. After all, we're just investigating and studying the thing now, and if something comes up wrong, we won't go ahead. But it's time for you to stop interfering with things. And if you don't stop, we'll pass a law that says you don't have any role in it anymore. And they said, oh, no, okay. Keep giving us money to monitor the program. So they're doing that.
Dr. Rawson, thank you so much for joining us.
Nice to be here, Moira.
My guest today has been Dr. David Rawson, a former Assistant Secretary of Energy. He is the immediate past president of the American Nuclear Society. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called the Big Chill.
We're living between ice ages. All of recorded history has taken place in a relatively warm interlude during a 2-million-year-old glacial period. Yet geological evidence tells us that the world used to be consistently warmer than even during this mild interglacial reprieve that we're now enjoying. It was also wetter, with rainfall evenly distributed throughout the year. Forests covered much of the globe, and grasslands and deserts were virtually non-existent. Then, some 40 million years ago, the climate began to grow colder and drier. And today, thick ice caps cover Antarctica and Greenland. Deserts stretch across much of Africa and Asia. And the range of forests is tiny compared to what it used to be. What could have caused this global climatic shift? Many climatologists believe that the decreasing level of carbon dioxide played a major role in Earth's transformation from warm to cool. Carbon dioxide is critical to Earth's climate because, like glass enclosing a greenhouse, CO2 allows sunlight energy to enter while inhibiting less energetic infrared wavelengths from leaving. The more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the more heat is trapped and the warmer the global climate. And vice versa. When CO2 levels fall, it gets cooler. 40 million years ago, the atmosphere probably contained at least 5 times the present amount of CO2. The decrease that began at that time has been linked to a major geological event. 40 million years ago, India collided with Asia, initiating an era of mountain building which continues to this day. For tens of millions of years, India's collision with southern Asia has been creating what's been called the biggest rock in the world, the Tibetan Plateau. The Himalayas are merely the southern rampart of an area one-third the size of the United States and 3 miles high. Computer models show that one consequence of the formation of the Tibetan Plateau is the monsoon, which drenches Southeast Asia every summer. Like a giant rock in a stream, the plateau altered the circulation of winds in the northern hemisphere, causing long-term climatic effects, including monsoon rains, in distant lands. This is where the carbon dioxide comes in. In falling, rain becomes a weak carbonic acid as it absorbs CO2 from the atmosphere. Once on the ground, the acid reacts with silicate rocks to form bicarbonates in a process known as chemical weathering. Rivers carry the bicarbonates to the ocean, where they are taken up by marine animals, and ultimately they sink to the sea floor. The net result is to remove CO2 from the atmosphere and trap it as limestone under the ocean. Normally, it's eventually returned to the atmosphere via volcanoes, but this process takes so long that an extended period of accelerated chemical weathering can lower the CO2 level sufficiently to initiate global cooling. Researchers believe this is what happened as the Tibetan Plateau was formed. As heavy monsoon rains fell on the steep, newly created mountain slopes, causing intense chemical weathering, higher than average amounts of CO2 were removed from the atmosphere. The global CO2 level fell, and our planet began its slow but inexorable shift to its present ice age climate. Next time you see a travelogue on Tibet, consider those vast uplands that were a major factor in turning Earth from warm and wet to relatively cool and dry. It may not seem that chilly right now, but come back in a few thousand years and you'll appreciate just how cold our prevailing climate really is. Oh, and don't forget your long underwear.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.